You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day, I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. It's just a crap because some people who were really smart made up and tried to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is as a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker. And a shot-smaller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered them all. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's podcast about the week in sports and nerds. Kate, you're already chomping at the bit. I can see.
Yeah, I'm so excited.
You seem amped today.
It's going to be a cathartic Hot Takedown.
Yeah,
I've been waiting for this for
lifting me
48
out of
hours.
My rest. That's Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. And in between us, Neil Payne, 538 sports writer. Hi, Neil.
Hey, what's up, Chad?
Have you recovered from the weekend events?
Sort of. How about you? I mean, you're the one I was worried about.
I was at game five, and I think I didn't speak. I was there with Nate. I don't think I spoke for 20 minutes at a stretch. It was a difficult.
It was 20 minutes after Lucas Duda's throw, or 20 minutes after the final out, or both.
Yeah, probably both. I mean, the extra innings were pretty tame anyway, and I they gave us rally towels, and I had the rally towel like squeezed as tight as possible over my head because I was just in such anguish.
Under the Twins hat?
Over the Twins hat.
Over the Twins hat.
Yes, I was wearing my Twins hat, my lucky Twins hat for the Mets to win. It didn't work out. Okay, so on this week's show, as you could hear, I tried to wriggle my way out of reliving the World Series, but Jody, our producer, said we couldn't. And so we will make sense of the Royals' victory, the Mets' collapse, and whether Terry Collins should be run out of town on Lucas Duda's shoulders. We'll pick up on our NBA preview conversation from a few weeks ago that happened when Mike Pesca was in the room, and that means the return of our Carmelo projections and Allison McCann to talk us through that. And then finally, we'll talk about the Rugby World Cup and how New Zealand, tiny New Zealand, won their third title because all of us don't know a scrum from a ruck. ESPN's Brett McKay will join us. Okay, you guys ready to talk baseball?
Let's do it.
Okay. In my notes here, to, you know, listeners, I make a little rundown before the show, try to have some bullet points. Some weeks it works better than others. This week's news intro for this segment is the Mets, period. Sad face. Guys, the Mets lost in five games to the Kansas City Royals. The other way to put that is the Royals won in five games.
If we didn't have such East Coast bias,
against
Chad.
The New York Mets. It was a fascinating series, I thought. Frank Thomas was also fascinated. Here's what he said after the series ended.
Mets have nothing to hold their heads down for, except they didn't play that well, and they gave away this World Series.
So aside from that, though,
they should be cheering.
They should feel pretty good.
Yeah. So did they give away the World Series? Do we have metrics about whether the Mets lost the World Series as opposed to the Royals winning it? From my layman's watching of it, the Mets gave away games for sure, but especially in that 12th inning in Game 5 when the Royals scored five runs, you just got the sense that even if this thing went seven games, that the Royals were better. But I'm trying to make sense of whether the Royals were better or not.
Well, didn't you feel too, Chad, like, and Neil, when the Royals tied it in the ninth, maybe the win projection said it was relatively even. I'm sure the Royals maybe had a slight edge. Maybe, Neil, you can confirm that. But if you asked me what our win percentage was after the Royals tied it in the ninth, I would have said fewer than 5% points. I just did not believe that they could win after that.
Right. It's one of those things where the win probabilities are based on historical models of sort of randomized, not randomized, but so many teams that it doesn't get into the particulars of whether a bullpen is good or not. Kate, you intuited rightfully that the Mets bullpen just was not going to be able to compete and stick with the Royals bullpen.
Yeah, I think that's right. Going to that play, after Hosmer scored on Lucas Duda's throw, which I found out yesterday was not an error. I had written that it was an error in a story and got some feedback saying, no, it actually wasn't an error. And then I was like, wait, what? How is that not an error? But as Chad explained to me later, it was because of the fielder's choice or, you know.
I think you can't assume a double play.
Right.
Or whatever.
In any event, after that particular play, It's still said that the Mets had a 60% chance of winning, according to win probability. And I think a lot of that has to do with having the bottom of the ninth still left to go. And if you look at after Travis d'Arnaud made the final out of the very quick bottom of the ninth to send it into extras, it was 50-50. So that's what you would expect kind of out of, you know, historical performances of teams from that point on.
So home field advantage goes away once you go to extra innings, is what you're saying.
I think it shrinks, and you know, I think Baseball Reference does take it into account. That's whose win probability we're looking at. I think it assumes that every extra inning onward sort of acts like it's the ninth inning again, and so any chance that you have to have home field is shrunk by, you know, like one ninth or whatever you would expect it to be at the beginning of the game. And it's also, we talked about it a few weeks ago, that baseball's home field really isn't that big compared to other sports. But, yeah, so that one particular play with Duda, just going back to that, only cost the Mets 9 percentage points, which was mind-blowing to me because, like you guys were saying, that felt like when that happened, just to the non-win probability follower at the time, just totally felt deflating and like, well, that's it. It's over.
Yeah. So,
And it felt to me, like, Chad, you were saying at the beginning of the segment, as how do we interpret it? Did the Mets give this away, or did the Royals win it? But that actual play where Duda didn't record an error, but, you know, threw the ball far left and Kansas City tied the game, it felt so much like a microcosm for the entire series in that, and the fact that he's even trying to take home on that is forcing the Mets to react and make a play. And that's like what it was like all series. It was like they were doing, they were making so many plays where it was like you couldn't even look at the percentage points or statistically what the Mets should have done. All you knew is that it was like we were constantly under siege. That's what it felt like. I felt like every moment you were kind of like, well, did the Mets give this away or did the Royals just constantly make all these calculated decisions about how to put as much stress on the Mets as possible until finally at some point in the game you could see like a little crack. And then you're like, well, okay, the Mets kind of gave that away, but also this is like the way the Royals have played all year long in that they're constantly putting that kind of pressure on.
Right, and you know, maybe the degree to which you say that it is the Royals winning or the Mets giving it away depends on largely on your fan affiliation, I think. But
or if you're a Mets fan, then you think even more that your team gave it away.
Yeah, I think that's true. Yeah, I think that is true. But you know, if you look at win probability, we'll come back to it, even though we just talked a little junk about it. That you know, the Mets had opportunities, for instance, before Jairus Familia threw that pitch in game one in the bottom of the ninth to Alex Gordon, there was an 89% chance that the Mets would win. So they had an 89% chance of winning game one at one point. And then if you go to game four and you look at the top of the eighth inning, so the Daniel Murphy error, there was a 67% chance that the Mets would win. So it wasn't as ironclad, but it still was very late in the game, and they had, you know, a pretty substantial chance of winning. And then, as we mentioned in that fateful fifth inning before all of the you know, the Duda non-error, and even
fifth
when
game, ninth inning.
When Matt Harvey, when Matt Harvey, before he came back out for the ninth inning, there was a 94% chance that the Mets would win the game. So if viewed through that perspective, you had multiple games that you lost where you gave up in excess of 85% win probability. And, when, you know, that has to feel like you gave it away in, to
Frank
a certain
Thomas
extent.
Frank Thomas is right.
And then also there was some research done at Fangraphs where they looked at, well, maybe the Royals' aggressive base running induces teams into making errors. You know, you could kind of see the argument for that. Like, there's a lot of chaos happening on the base paths when you play the Royals, so maybe you're more inclined to make errors. But then they found that the Royals' rate of reaching on error was no different than the overall major league average during the regular season. So that's another area where it doesn't seem like it was, like, forced by the Royals. It was almost like, to use a tennis term, it was an unforced error in the case of Murphy and in the case of Duda, not technically an error, but certainly a poor throw.
And real quick, I just want to play a quick hot take from the beginning of the World Series, since we're already talking about what A-Rod on Fox had to say about how the Mets could win.
It was more funny back then.
Yeah, I totally agree. Now it's weirdly poignant. Yeah. So let's listen to what A-Rod had to say.
If the Mets catch the baseball, they will be world champions.
Right, when that first happened, I was like, LOL.
Yeah, it sounded
A-Rod.
A little like,
that's so silly.
Of course you could win if you catch
the NFL and still win.
And now I'm like, he is a brilliant analyst.
Yeah, totally. Okay, and so I do want to talk about some managerial decisions.
Just
a little bit.
Just one or two.
Ned Yost coming to the World Series, sort of famous for bunting too much, for deploying his best arms in his bullpen in the wrong leverage spots, you know, sticking with an eighth inning man, even if in the seventh inning you need that great pitcher. And yet Terry Collins just got it handed to him, it seems to me. And this isn't even about confusing process outcome for process here. He left Jacob DeGrom, I think, in at one point with the bases loaded. Was it DeGrom? It was Syndergaard in with the bases loaded in Game 3 when clearly Syndergaard should have been coming out third time through the order as well. We had Harvey coming out for a fourth trip through the order. We had Cespedes finishing an at-bat at Game 5 in which he could not perform the ability that he is paid to perform.
With the bases loaded.
Right.
And we somehow in that moment we were happy to get one run. We were like, oh, well, another run. Who cares? We got Matt Harvey's throwing.
Yeah, the Royals won't
blistering.
Come back on the Mets. That doesn't seem likely.
I remember even in that moment being like, why do I feel okay with one run? This is going to hurt at some point.
Yeah, and then it did. So, Neil, you've written before about managers.
Right.
And about how hard it is to gauge a manager's success or value, rather, to a team. And I think something you once wrote said that, like, no manager is worth more than two wins or two losses during the regular season. The postseason, though, it just seems like it's so different. It's so radically different because the stakes are so high and because you have more pitchers to play with and more substitutions to worry about. And you don't have to worry about the long-term health of pitchers and things like that. Am I wrong to think that?
Maybe. You know, you think about the regular season. You know, everything that happens in the playoffs, even though the attention is just so much greater on it, I do feel like it's not that different from the regular season. Like, you know, you have a 4-man rotation instead of a 5, and yeah, you manage the bullpen a lot closer. But I think also we just have a lot more scrutiny on every tiny decision that's made. Whereas during the regular season, I think if, you know, Terry Collins leaves Matt Harvey out too long in a game in June, yeah, he's going to get some, you know, criticism for it, but there's another game to be played the very next day, and so it kind of blows over faster than that. Whereas with these, there's nothing else to distract us, so we kind of microanalyze everything. And maybe the strength of a manager like Terry Collins, certainly the Mets vastly overperformed expectations this year, and so did the Royals. Famously, they were projected to win 72 games as defending American League champs by PECOTA, which is Baseball Prospectus's projection system. Both of these managers, their biggest value might be in that like day-to-day process of just, you know, managing the team in the clubhouse and sort of, you know, over the long haul extracting wins out of the talent that they have. But then once you get into the playoffs and everything is magnified, you know, maybe I'm just throwing a number, pulling it out of thin air, but maybe like 90% of all of those little tinkering moves, even during the regular season, are, you know, whether they work out or not is due to luck in a small sample, and it balances out over 162 games. And in the playoffs, you get punished or credited for your luck on top of what decisions you actually made, and then everything gets blown so hugely out of proportion that it's easy for a manager that maybe during the season, and I think of Bobby Cox, who was the Braves manager for many, many years, Hall of Famer this past year, the Braves consistently during that run that they had of winning the division, they over, you know, performed relative to expectations every year. But then the Braves underperformed in the playoffs, and I think the book on Bobby Cox was always like, he is a really good manager at the long game and extracting wins out of talent, and then not very good at the game management things that happened during the playoffs. And so that's why you saw that phenomenon, or maybe he even managed every game during the regular season like it was a playoff game, and then once you get to the playoffs, everyone is managing every game that same way, and so then you kind of lose that edge that you have. So that's one theory that I've heard, you know, even sabermetric people throw around with regard to that. But I don't know. I think a lot of it is just we're attributing these outcomes to, you know, decisions that could have worked out. Matt Harvey could have gotten three outs. In fact, the odds said that, you know, he's more likely to do that than not before giving up two runs, or he and Familia together. So, yeah, I think that it's easy to criticize these things after the fact, though.
And you mentioned blowing it out of proportion. I think that's the tendency we're going to have when it's a lasting image or thought, and then there's a lot of empty space. In the same way that we felt after the Seahawks-Patriots and the final play of the decision to pass, it's like it's sort of the same dissection of one play. And I try and go back to, like, how did I feel in the moment of watching the play? So when it came to the Super Bowl, I was like, well, when they went back to pass, what was my emotion in that moment? What did I think about it? So I'm kind of extracting and putting to the side now all the information I have.
Yeah, without knowing what you know now.
And so I'm trying to go back to how I felt watching the Mets game and seeing Matt Harvey and watching Fox show us the replay of him going up to Collins and being like, no way, no way, no way. I went through various emotions. I was very much 50% in the middle lane, bouncing between, that's right, he's going to throw a complete game. It's going to be epic. I was like picturing the back of the Daily News and the New York Post, what that would look like when he threw a complete game shutout. And then I was sort of like flagging for myself also, okay, but also there's something frightening me about the fact he's demanding to go back out on the mound. It's like he's setting himself up for this disaster. But I was still very much like 50-50, not sure how I truly felt, if I was against it or for it.
And that's funny because in the moment, just taking off the Statman cape, I was screaming at the TV that this is a horrible mistake, and that, you know, he's putting his ego ahead of the team and trying to prove some kind of point about what had happened earlier in the season and about the pitch, the innings limit and all that stuff. So I think emotionally, you know, when I went back and ran the numbers days later, I was like, oh, there really wasn't that much of a difference. And, you know, Hosmer hitting that double and then subsequently the two run scoring was a very unlikely event, no matter whether it happened off of Harvey, off of Familia, off of what actually happened, Harvey and Familia in combination. Either way, that was just going to be a really unlikely set of circumstances, no matter who was in.
Chad, how did you feel? Take us through what you were thinking sitting in the stands.
I wanted Harvey to come back.
Why?
Because I was not convinced that Familia – I was convinced that Familia might –
he'd already run out of gas. Saves.
He'd pitched two straight days when he should have only pitched one. And so Familia's tricky. The first game, he had one bad pitch. He pitched pretty well. The second game, not totally his fault. Right. So it's a little difficult. So I was cheering.
Did you get into the narrative of having Harvey come back out?
Oh, absolutely.
Without a doubt, being in the stands?
Absolutely. Okay. I mean, there were 50,000 people who, by the way, this was Harvey's redemption narrative, right? He was a hypocrite during the year, didn't want to pitch in the playoffs, and here he is with the chance to pitch a complete game, you know, and test that Tommy John elbow, and here's the chance to finally put it to rest.
Last home game of the season.
Right. So now, we don't have a ton of time to keep talking about this, but I just want to talk about the Royals for 1 second.
No. Let's stick with the Mets.
Let's be respectful.
Fine. Right?
Give some credit where it's due.
So, the Royals were projected to be a sub-500 team at the beginning of the season.
Well, so
now they're World Series champions. Neil, does that shake your faith in all that is holy in sabermetrics?
No, I mean, I think that there are lessons to be learned, and there's a lot of articles coming out in the days after they won to try to figure out, like, what did the Royals do to kind of crack the code, or is there a code to have been cracked? We would expect a team projected as poor as the Royals to win as many games as they did, about 2 out of every 100 seasons. So, you know, it's not that common for sure. But then at the same time, it will happen from time to time. And, there may be something people are trying to link, like, oh, the Royals had really good clutch stats, meaning that they performed better in high leverage situations than they did in low leverage situations. And maybe that's linked to all of the endless parade of contact hitters that they had. there may be something to that. If you look at the all-time leaderboard of Fangraphs clutch stat, which, you know, is the difference between high leverage performance and low leverage performance, all of them are a bunch of contact hitters. And so there may be something about being able to put the ball in play that is more valuable in high leverage moments than low leverage ones. And the value of having a great defense. They had arguably, you know, definitely the best defense of this year, one of the best of all time. And then also the value of having a fantastic relief pitching, you know, core. So I think there's a lot of ways that you can build it. It was a very well-built team. They went out during the season and they took a good risk at the trade deadline and got, you know, bolstered their lineup. And so by the end of the year, I think that they, I don't think anyone was saying they were that 72-win team. Even mm-hmm. Fangraphs rest of season projections probably had them as like a true talent 85 to 90 win team. That's good enough to win the World Series nowadays. I think the average World Series winner over the past, you know, since they put in the wild card is like 90 wins or something like that, 88 to 90 wins.
Okay. I think this is sort of helpful, Kate. I'm with you, though. You're snarling in disappointment still about this outcome.
I just was more upset than I thought I was going to be.
Yeah. I mean, Carl Bialik, our colleague who's been on Hot Takedown a few times, was taking the understandable sort of like, but look how lucky we got to be, you know,
right.
argument,
true,
which
we
was,
were
we
still
talked about
Murphy.
Baseball. Well, we talked about Murphy last week and about how, like, why would we expect, you know, getting to this required a miraculous performance by Murphy. So why would you not expect, you know, something negative also? Why not accept that when that happens?
Right. Okay. Next year, baseball.
Always next year.
We'll be back. Okay. On to the NBA, where the season is a few days old, but if we've learned anything from this podcast, it's that just a few games don't necessarily teach us anything about the league, which means we can still do a preview, right, guys?
Yeah.
It's not like
it's
anything.
It's like it hasn't even started yet.
Yeah, totally. And we cannot preview the NBA without using Carmelo and without talking to Allison McCann. Hello, Allison.
Hey, Chad.
So we're going to preview the Western Conference because I think the podcast that I wasn't here a few weeks ago, you guys didn't get to it. Can we start with Kobe, guys?
Yes.
So Kobe,
is that a new projection system?
Yeah, it's his rival projection. He's competitive with Carmelo. So Kobe, after a loss to the Mavericks this season, was sort of, you know, thinking existentially about his place in the league, and really what it was, and this is what he had to say.
What's the fastest way to turn this thing around, Kobe?
Well, if I make a damn shot, that'll help. I suck right now, dude.
You don't have any issues, health issues right now?
Yeah, it's I'm the 200th best player in the league right now. Freaking suck.
So, Allison, is Kobe the 200th best player in the league right now? Does he freaking suck?
This is where we come in with the like, actually, Kobe, you are the 236th best player in the league right now. This is based on our sort of more far-reaching Carmelo. Actually, Andrew Flowers and Neil Payne did sort of this looking at the next 6 years of Carmelo rather than just what's going on the season right now. And if by that metric we look at Kobe, he drops even more down to 468th.
Because as he ages, he's going to get so much worse.
Yeah, but currently he was actually in the ballpark, which we were a little bit surprised to say 200th. He threw it up, definitely threw that out there, and he wasn't far off.
He's rounding down.
This is like my favorite thing about Kobe is that he was trying to throw out some number that was just preposterous that he could be the 200th worst player, and he actually undershot what's actually going on.
He was too generous to himself.
He was actually, you're worse than the number that you thought was beyond what you could possibly be.
Yeah. But so my question for Kobe is, like, he's clearly a pretty self-aware guy. I feel like he, every time I hear him give an interview, he's, I don't know, Neil, you're scrunching your face, but I think, like, he knows if he's shooting too much and he's still doing it for various reasons about what he thinks that it'll take for the team to win. I think he knows, like, a lot about himself and his place in the league. So why continue, aside from the $30 million or whatever it is, to play if you clearly pride yourself on being the best and you know that you're the 200th best?
I want to hear why Neil was scrunching his face there about the self-awareness, because I would agree that over the last 2 to 3 years, Kobe's self-awareness seems to have grown in terms of how he talks about himself.
Yeah.
I'm not as concerned about why he's playing as why he's playing the way he's playing, and I don't mean quality. I mean, why isn't he just a veteran presence who's trying to help the other guys around him grow? Like, why is it still seem to be about Kobe's number of shots and shooting percentage, and why isn't it about handing over the keys to the kingdom?
Right. Well,
there's a lot in there for you, Neil.
Yeah,
so.
I know. So first of all, I was scrunching about just the – I agree with you, actually, about, like, the last 3 years or however many. He really has, like – I think Kobe has stopped really, like, caring what anyone thought. Not that he cared that much before, but I think there was an element to Kobe, especially early in his career. Now we're kind of psychoanalyzing him. But he seemed very conscious and very, like, measured. So in that sense, he was self-aware. But he was self-aware about trying to project a certain image of himself that was not necessarily who he actually was. But I think you're right. Now, in the past few years, he has become just this kind of grumpy old man, which I think he always was to a certain extent. And so now he's embraced it. And so maybe that's the idea that he is being more valid to who he is stronger now than ever. And thinking about the team, I do think that that really is interesting because now he has like a bunch of young guys on the team with him, like Julius Randle, D'Angelo Russell, guys that, you know, he could be playing like a secondary role too. He could be facilitating. And yet, you know, he still has that usage rate over 30%. And they're not good. I mean, it would be different if he were carrying them and they were, you know, he was single-handedly leading this crew and sort of taking one for the team.
And Neil, you said that Carmelo had thought that Kobe was going to suck more this season and that he's actually performing about average or better than we expected. So
right, yeah. Like, so I looked at as of, I guess, through last night's game. So it's only like three games for Kobe, four for like some teams in the league. Who had the biggest disparity between what Carmelo said they would be and who they actually were? So Steph Curry is exceeding expectations by the most, and Chris Middleton, clutch shots notwithstanding, is playing below expectations. But what was really funny was Kobe is actually slightly playing better than what Carmelo thought he would. So another indicator of like Kobe in his mind thinks that he is just playing horrifically. And it's like, nah, we kind of knew right. that you were capable of this.
This is, you know, dude.
So you mentioned Steph Curry through four games. I mean, the Warriors look really good. Steph Curry looks maybe even better than the Warriors in a way. He has scored 148 points. I feel like has made so many passes that we did not know human beings could make in professional basketball and not on a street court or something. So Allison, how good was Curry supposed to be according to Carmelo? Is one question I have. And then this year, that is, whether Carmelo can tell us that. And then my other question is, like, what would it mean if a player like Curry, who's in his prime, starts to exceed even our projections of his prime? Like, does that mean that the models are thinking of him in too pedestrian of a way? Or, you know, I'm trying to make sense of what that means when someone deviates that much from the numbers.
That was very, like, I don't know, esoteric or something. But
especially, Allison.
I do think it's interesting that he seemed like one of the few where, like, he didn't have a lot of buts. Like, even with LeBron and other players that Carmelo really liked, like, we were just like, oh, like, we liked Carmelo, like Steph Curry and all of his stats. He is our, you know, second pick for our upside war. So that's, you know, looking at his future the next 6 years. The only person above him is Anthony Davis, who is 22 years old. And, you know, Steph Curry is 27 years old. So he has this 5-year gap. But, you know, he is in the 99th percentile in his true shooting, his usage, his assist.
But he's supposed to be worse this year than last year. And is that because last year was so crazy that, like, we could not imagine him getting better, basically?
And it was inevitable that he
would regress.
He would regress, yeah.
Yeah, since it's based on, like, other players from history and players, you know, don't tend to have back-to-back seasons as good as Steph Curry has. And, you know, there's nothing saying that worth four games into the season. And it bears mentioning that through these first four games, he, according to Box Plus Minus, which is a stat at Basketball Reference, he is on pace, and I say that in air quotes, for the best season anyone ever had in NBA history.
After four games.
Well, no, just like comparing to other stretch, you know, comparing his four games to full season. So it's kind of a BS comparison to make. And I'm sure there were other people who out there through four games also had stats this crazy. And we also say this knowing full well that he'll probably revert toward whatever Carmelo said he was. But it's a very good start for him so far.
I think the one thing when you look at Steph's, even like his heat chart on his shooting map, like where he's taking shots from, the one thing that I flag that makes me think, not that he can hold up this pace, but that he might be as good, if not slightly better than he was last year, was the fact that he's taking so much higher percentage of his shots in the paint. And of course, it's only four games, so you're not sure if he's going to be able to hold that up, but it does kind of follow this trend, you know, that we talk about all the time, like get your, you know, score in the paint and then also three-point shooting. And it's not impossible to think that he could excel in that way when you actually look and read about like all the certain training he's done in the off season with like light training about quicker reaction times. And there's certain things maybe you could say he'd get better on, like isolations and stuff, which he's great at to begin with, but could he improve in that way? So I think when you look at like the training he did in the off season, and you never know with the Carmelo model, like when you're comparing him to other people, the kind of technological advances that now exist for off-season training and ways guys can get better that they could never get better, that I'm not thinking we can take into account when we do these Carmelo projections.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, Chris Paul is his number one comp, and so Chris Paul is a contemporary, right, at least in his same era. Ray Allen was able to take advantage of them. He's the number three comp, you know, as he aged far more gracefully than probably he would have if he had been dropped down into the 70s or whatever. And then you see like Terrell Brandon, who is his second most comparable player from the past, was wrecked by injury and, you know, was not the same player from round about this point in his career. And so who's to know if Terrell Brandon had, you know, 2015 technology, if he could have recovered from some of the injuries that he had. So I think, yeah, that's definitely a great point.
And here's a stat, though, that Tom Haverstraw tweeted that's ridiculous, saying that if Curry went 0 for his next 88 from 3, he would still have a higher 3 percentage than James Harden. 0 for 88.
In his career.
Yes, exactly. Wow. Not like over the season. My God.
Wow. So I also, Allison, want to hear what treasures you uncovered in doing Carmelo for the Western Conference. So have we explained what Carmelo is during this segment? Maybe not.
If we really,
it's a projection system that takes into account all sorts of historical factors and tries to find comparable players for
offensive
NBA players.
This is offensive.
Wow.
Why? Can't they tone my voice? I'm doing it. We're doing a methodology note.
No, I'm bored kidding. He's bored of it.
No, not at all. We're just, you know, it's throat clearing.
Allison spent like 3 months.
Allison, would you like to?
Carmelo is my baby.
Yeah.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm
that's how I talk about people's babies too. I'm just like, oh, no, little Johnny. He can't, you know, he was born on July 7th. Anyway, it's a projection system that takes into account lots of stats and tries to find comparable players to figure out whether or not Brooke Lopez is going to be the next Dikembe Mutombo or George Monroe. Was that a reasonable?
What do we think about
Greg
your tone?
Greg Monroe. Who's George Monroe?
I don't know.
Must be some guy. He's a hot takedown listener. Yeah. So anyway,
George
Allison.
Monroe is out there saying, oh my God, they mentioned me.
This is one of the better asides that hot takedown's gone on. Allison, when you were looking at various players' Carmelo projections, were there any that really surprised or that made you think, oh wait, who's that guy again?
Yeah, I mean, so we had these sort of like categories that we very statistically and rigorously assigned.
And by we mean Nate.
Players too. So for me, it was very fun to look at some of these like lesser known, you know, not the Steph Currys, not the James Hardens and stuff. So I kind of grabbed a few of my favorites from the Western Conference. And I will drop a few here. Lance Stevenson, I think it's Neil who wrote that he has a penchant for over-dribbling and ill-advised shots.
Sounds like something I'd write.
Erratic talents. But Carmelo sort of puts him in this defensive specialist position. He has above-average rebounding and defensive plus-minus figures. His upside war over the next 6 years is a little grim. He ranks 184th out of, I think, our
better than Kobe.
582 players, yeah. Manu Ginobili. I can never pronounce his last
Ginobili.
Name.
Ginobili.
Yeah, last name.
Do that again.
We should do that again.
Manu Ginobili.
Can you say it the way you said it the first time, though?
Keep that.
Let's keep that for like an outtake.
Okay.
Compilation.
From the Spurs, Manu Ginobili. You guys, stop making fun of me. He's 38. His skills are definitely declining, but he actually gets put in this key role player. And for me, like, Carmelo does not like old dudes. So I thought it was interesting that he actually gets sort of a positive stat. He, you know, gets compared to legends like Scottie Pippen is one of his comps. And he remains very important to the Spurs. I guess he sort of runs the second group offense and stuff. So he was really fun to me. Dion Waiters, the Thunder, I guess, were trounced by the Grizzlies a few weeks ago. Thanks in part to Dion's awfulness. I guess he was about 25% from the floor and 0 for 5 from 3. And Carmelo calls him a project, which I love. It's kind of like, who knows? This guy could be great or terrible. So those were a few of my favorites from the Western Conference that are more in the, like, the crapshoot Carmelo category.
That's your NBA fantasy team is comprised just of the projects from Carmelo.
Okay. Dion Waiters gets past the ball on your fantasy team, I feel like, unlike when he was playing with LeBron.
That's one of my favorite vines of all time.
Oh, my God.
Is him calling for the ball when LeBron has it.
I don't think I've seen that vine.
We'll link to it
and
on
then
the website.
Seeming so disappointed when he didn't get it. And LeBron is totally like, of course I'm not going to ever pass it to you.
On the three-point line when you're terrible.
But
is
I think
he terrible?
He's not good.
He's okay. I also think it's worth mentioning, since we talked a lot about the Eastern Conference last time, and Neil's written a lot about just how much more competitive the Western Conference is. You know, the drop in the Eastern Conference between the Cavs and the next best team is almost 14 wins in the Western Conference. It's about 3 wins. It's way tighter at the top. You can go read all of our Western Conference previews, but I think it's a much more exciting side of the NBA. Maybe Neil can tell you a
this
little bit.
This is all a ploy for you to move to California.
Honestly. Yeah. I will be the Western
West
Conference.
West Coast.
Carmelo correspondent.
That also sends you to, like, not Western places at all, right? There's, like,
right.
Like
you can hang out in Texas
teams
a lot.
In the Western Conference. Yeah.
Oh, right. Yeah,
Utah,
yeah.
Memphis.
Yeah.
Memphis a lot. Yeah.
Anyway, I don't know. Neil, what are the, I guess, there's just better teams, but, like, has there always been this sort of lopsidedness, or does this feel particularly lopsided this year?
Yeah, I mean, we're always kind of in a moment where we're asking, like, is this historically the biggest difference between the West and the East? Because it seems like the West has been so much better than the East for, like, going on a decade and a half now or longer. But yeah, 6 of the 7 teams that we projected to win 50 or more games are in the West. And I think we said like 5 of the 6 best teams in the NBA, and the only one that isn't is the Cavs are in the West. So it's kind of business as usual, but the West is just, you know, perpetually the better conference. And I think they've, like, drafted better and made better trades and just, you know, have all the good players are out West.
Can we just commit ourselves to, like, a Porzingis segment at some point,
yes,
though?
Yes, yeah. We will Porzingis. Don't worry. And we will make Porzingis a verb. Okay, Allison, thanks so much for stopping by. You will be back for Sig Dig, of course.
Yes, of course.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
New Zealand beat Australia 34-17 to win the Rugby World Cup. We'd love to pretend we know what that means, but we actually don't really know what that score means. To help, we have Brett McKay with us, who writes for ESPN Scrum and hosts his own sports podcast, The Cheap Seats Pod. Hello, Brett.
G'day, Chad. How are you going?
Good. Thank you. I'm going well. I love that. Brett, we always start our segments off with a hot take of sorts, and I want to start with a hot take before you help us know what's going on in rugby and in the Rugby World Cup. So here's Peter Bisley, who's a rugby writer in New Zealand, telling us that the All Blacks, the New Zealand team, played a little like their Maori war dance, the haka.
There's that line in Kapa Opango, now it's time for Aotearoa to thunder. And that's what we saw. It was a tsunami of total rugby. I mean, it's really hard to single out individual players because 1 to 15, and then with the bench as well, you just have 23 players who are all on top of their game.
So, Brett, what is a tsunami of total rugby? Why is New Zealand so good?
Yeah, look, it's a question that has been bugging us in Australia for about 10 years, if we're completely honest about it. The Wallabies certainly haven't had the best record against New Zealand in that time. Look, this is an absolute champion side. There's no other way around it. Since the last World Cup, and New Zealand won the last Rugby World Cup that they hosted themselves in 2011, they've only lost three tests out of 60 games in that time. So they're just a remarkable team. They're very, very well coached. The skill levels within that side are just phenomenal. And even their systems are so strong in New Zealand and around the sides that feed into the All Blacks that even if a key player is out, then they can drop in, you know, the next in line, if you like, and they already know the systems. There's a fair chance they've already played 20 or 30 tests themselves. And, you know, the ship just carries on, if you like. And so that's what makes them so dangerous and so hard to beat. Everyone knows their job on any given day, and anyone's capable of dropping in and doing that job from the moment the ball's kicked off.
So that sounds like a testament to, like, coaching and the system, yeah. Especially since they're such a tiny country. They have such a small pool of players to pull from. How can they kind of maintain the standard that they've maintained so far?
Well, rugby is the national sport in New Zealand, essentially. That's what it boils down to. So, yeah, they're a small population, only 4.5 million. Five professional teams in New Zealand that play in the same Super Rugby competition that we play in Australia and also South Africa. And those five professional teams dotted around New Zealand are all very much on the same page. It's not like the All Blacks come over the top and say, you must play this way, but they all sort of naturally get on board for the national good anyway. And as I say, it means that, you know, a player can be dropped in from any of those five teams and they pretty well know the score already. So I think of someone like Beauden Barrett, who scored the match-winning try. He came off the bench with about 20 minutes, half an hour to go. He's already played, I think, about 35 or 40 tests. Only a fairly young guy, but he's played a lot of test match rugby off the bench. And if Dan Carter does move on, like he's suggested he will, then Beauden Barrett is, you know, placed really well to take up that that fly half position, the number 10 jersey.
Hey, Brett, I was wondering, it's probably going to be 2016 Olympics where, you know, a lot of people here in the U.S. are like, okay, rugby. What's going on here? Like, who are we paying attention to? I was wondering, because I know it's rugby sevens that have inclusion in the Olympics in Rio. Can you kind of lay down for us the difference in rugby sevens versus rugby? And also, like, what the landscape is about which teams are really strong in rugby sevens?
Yeah, well, Kate, It's a lot of the same teams, if I'm honest. So certainly New Zealand have been one of the very best sevens team over the last little bit for the same reasons that I just talked about there for their 15 side. So obviously the difference with sevens is that there's, you know, less players. There's only three forwards, four backs, as opposed to eight forwards, seven backs in 15s. It's all played in the same size field. There's still, you know, scrums, lineouts, that sort of thing, but it's obviously just condensed and there's less participants. But sevens is all very much about running rugby. It's all very open. It can be a little bit scrappy at times, but it can be really, really exciting. And I think that's what's going to really appeal to you guys over there going into the Olympics next year. And obviously, you know, we see what the Las Vegas sevens are like. It's, you know, it's a massive, the sevens World Series is just like this massive big carnival of open rugby and partying around the world, if you like, and it's a fantastic event. You know, as I say, we know what Las Vegas is like. The Wellington Sevens in New Zealand are always a great event each year. Sydney hosts its first Sevens tournament in early February next year, and there's a really big air of excitement around our tournament here early next year as well.
So, Brett, we are somewhat obsessed about analytics and metrics around here because we think they have some insight to shed. Is there a sabermetrics of rugby? Is there somebody who's tracking player movements or ball movement or looking at the way tries work and what the best spot on the field is for one or anything like that?
To a degree, and certainly the statistics that we, the public, if you like, get and see is very different to what the teams use themselves. So if we look up and I'm just looking at the ESPN Scrum scorecard for the World Cup final, for example, and there's some stats there that talks about tackles made and tackles missed, for example. And so Australia made 117 tackles, missed 27. New Zealand made 114 tackles and missed 15 for the game. So we know that straight away there, New Zealand have attempted about 130 tackles and Australia is upwards of about 150. So there's tackle success rates, 81 and 88% success in that in those particular rankings. So they're the public figures, if you like. The teams themselves would break down those tackles more, and they would have their own metrics about whether whether a missed tackle, for example, led to a turnover. So if a missed tackle slows a player down enough for another player to come in over the top and pilfer the ball, essentially, then they'd actually still class that as a positive involvement rather than just what we see as a missed tackle. There's also things, there's breakdowns, and this is one that's known quite well about New Zealand, that they score most of their points in the sort of 10 to 15 minute period either side of half time. The All Blacks sort of refer to this time as the championship period, and particularly that moment, that the 15 minutes after half time. That's more often than not, that's when they really put the foot down and really choke teams out of games. And even in the World Cup final, New Zealand scored their first try of the, also their second try of the game, within about 90 seconds of half time, and that was the moment where Australian hearts really sank. That was when we really had that feel of inevitability about it, if you like. It was a fantastic fight back, obviously, from there, but when New Zealand score that second try and they go out to 21-3, we start having all those feelings that we've had for the last 10 or 12 years that, we're going to get done by New Zealand again. So there certainly is metrics and stats around, but as I say, what we see and what the commentators will use in games will more often than not be quite different to what the teams use themselves.
So I have one more question, then Kate, I think, has a burning question.
I do.
That we'll get to close the segment. I think we saw with soccer the way that a sport grows into a more global audience, and it was largely through TV deals. Like, I feel like that now the EPL is on NBC Sports, along with the World Cup coverage for soccer, that there's a real, at least in America, footprint for soccer here, and we have the MLS, of course, as well. Is rugby or some global body of rugby interested in expanding the game like we saw FIFA try to expand the game elsewhere, or is it something that's a bit more provincial and a bit more okay being at where it is?
No. There's definite interest and definite motives to expand the game globally, and particularly into the Americas. The Americas and Asia is probably the big growth area for rugby nationally, and there's a lot of anticipation around the formation of a professional league in America. We've been hearing about this for probably 3 or 4 years now, and the mail's been getting a little bit stronger of late that USA Rugby is now working fairly hard in conjunction with another group to get a professional league going around the States, and possibly with one or two teams in Canada as well. And that would be enormous for the professional game in the States, obviously. South America has always been a fairly strong rugby area. Obviously, soccer's their main sport down there. But Uruguay, Argentina, all qualified and played in this Rugby World Cup. Brazil aren't too sort of ranked in the mid 20s there as well. There's always been that rugby element down there, and it'll be through expansions of tournaments and Canada and the US and Argentina, Uruguay, as I mentioned, will start playing more internationals in tournaments that will sort of be like an American version of the Six Nations in Europe, where England, France, Ireland, etc. all play. But I think what could really kick the game off in your part of the world is certainly the Sevens next year at the Olympics will help. But I think if at some point in the next 10, 15, 20 years, the US could host a Rugby World Cup, then I think, just as we saw with soccer after the, was it not 1994, the Soccer World Cup was in the States. Yeah, well, I mean, soccer blew up after that in America, didn't it? So I think that's what could be the real big catalyst. We've already seen the All Blacks and Australia have played tests against the US in Chicago in the last two years or so, and I think we'll start seeing more of that. I think there's a recognition that the US is a real growth opportunity for the game internationally, and we'll start seeing more top tier games played in your neck of the woods.
Hey, Brett, I know you have to run, but a question: Are you a coffee drinker?
I am, and over the course of the Rugby World Cup, with 2 and 3 a.m. starts for me in Australia time, I've been drinking a lot of coffee of late.
Okay. Okay, can you explain for me what a flat white is? Please? They're popping up everywhere around, and I want to know if I should drink it.
I can do my best. It's essentially a shot of espresso, and then it's, you know, it's your crema milk on top of that, essentially.
Is it different? Is the steaming process different than a latte, or am I getting too detailed here?
No, well, look, Kate, this is what's bugged me, because, you know, theoretically, there's not a lot of difference between a latte and a flat white. And if I understand it right, it's the order of milk first or last, essentially. That's the difference. But the average coffee shop in Australia certainly doesn't necessarily do it that way. If you ask for a flat white and you ask for a latte, more often than not, they make it the same way. So
This is the debut of Kate's spin-off podcast. Yeah,
I know. I can see it's going well. And look, Kate, keep asking these sorts of questions, then you're going to get the bigger share of the podcast. And, you know, then there'll be the rugby offshoot. So, you know, keep going with that.
All right, Brad, we'll leave you to drink your coffee, because I think it is like 6 in the morning where we're talking to you now.
Just after 8:30 a.m.
Oh, all right. You're already fueled.
Yeah, that's right. I do have to keep running, though, guys. It's been great to talk to you.
Okay, thanks, Brett.
Cheers.
Moving on from rugby, we are at the time for the significant digit, where we give some number in the sports news that tells us something about the wider world of sports, and we cannot do it without Allison McCann, who's back in the studio. Hi, Allison.
I'm back.
All right.
I'm back.
What do you got?
This is a fun one this week, a light one. 38 years, which is the longest New York City Marathon consecutive streak for women. It belongs to Connie Brown, a 71-year-old Florida woman who ran the marathon.
Of running in it for that many years?
38 straight years.
Whoa.
Yeah. Go on, Connie. She finished this year in 5 hours, 50 minutes, and 44 seconds, which is really good for
a
71-year-old.
For sure.
Oh, totally. Yeah.
Coincidentally, she was just 8 seconds ahead of Alicia Keys.
you buried the lead. Alicia Keys ran the marathon?
Yeah. So did Ethan Hawke. I saw him in Brooklyn.
I've seen him at the pie shop on the corner around my place.
I ran faster.
Did he 4 and 20 black words. Connie Brown.
Can I get free? Can I get free pie, please?
Back to Connie.
Sorry.
So you're telling. I have a bad Alicia Keys pun to make about where that New York is, where Connie's dreams are made of.
Wow.
I can start singing that song.
On that note,
is that a pun too?
No.
No. That was just a Chad you made.
Go ahead.
An awful
you have now offered to start singing.
I'm going to save it for a live show. I want a Hot Dick Town live show at some point.
We should do it outside on the streets of New York, like in Times Square, live show.
I sing New York, Empire State of Mind, all day when I walk down the streets, Kate.
I mean, I hum it in my head. Yeah. I was blown away. I live along the marathon route. Man, they clean up after that thing so quickly.
It is a logistical feat, for sure.
It's a little sad how they made Connie do all the work, though. So.
Did you read that story from last year that, like, brings me to tears, like, every time I read it, like, during marathon year, of, like, the man with prosthetics and the woman that was, like, was a cancer survivor that, like, finished together in, like, 18 hours or whatever, and they had shut down the roads, like, the cleanup people had come through, and, like, they were just, like, there's a bus that comes if you want to get on if you can't finish, and they were just, like, no, we're going to do it. It was, like, dark. Ugh. It's, like, it will make you...
We're going to have to link to that.
We'll also link to the New York Times really good marathon graphics around when different people were finishing as the course went on, which was really cool. Like the distribution curve of racers, which was really interesting. All right, Allison, thanks for coming through and telling us about Connie.
Thanks for having
me.
To
go,
the
Connie.
Show.
That's amazing.
Yeah. That's a streak.
Shout out to anyone that ran the marathon, though. It's totally very impressive.
All right, so that will do it for this week's show. Thanks, as always, to Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad.
To Neil Payne.
Thanks, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Jody Avergan, making his podcast production debut this week is Joe Sykes. Thanks for the help, Joe. Our video producer is Ryan Nantel. We get production assistance from Jordan Shulkin and Lois St. Jacques. Our intern is Sarah Patterson. You can email us at podcasts@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. And you can find us on SoundCloud, Stitcher, Downcast, all sorts of other apps, iTunes, of course, as well. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. And while you're there, please leave a review and rate the show. It helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. Thanks, Mystery Mansion, for those Game 3 World Series tickets. I'm Chadwick Matlin. I'll talk to you next time.